Veteran homelessness in Jacksonville is close to functional zero. That's according to advocacy group Changing Homelessness, but they can't get there without your help. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Thanks for listening. I'm Ryan Bankin for Melissa Ross. We're always live here at 9, and make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app. You can also hear our audio feed right now on the First Coast Connect Facebook page. And just ahead, Changing Homelessness CEO Don Gilman on the veterans surge. Then later, a new rule on the Labor Department may change the way brokers help you plan for retirement. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour. Duval County is well on its way to accomplishing its goal of reducing veteran and chronic homelessness to what's called functional zero. They've been inching closer and closer to that goal since March of last year. CEO Don Gilman said at the time they may reach that tipping point before the end of last year. Well, how are we doing? What barriers still exist to getting people stable and off the streets? Changing Homelessness CEO Don Gilman joins me now to talk about that and about its The Streets Don't Lie event next month. Give us a call with your thoughts. Have you experienced homelessness before? Has anyone in your family experienced homelessness? Do you have general questions or comments? Give us a call, 549-2937. Again, that number is 549-2937. Don, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So let's start with what functional zero means. I know that we've talked about this before, and you've talked about it on this show, on this program mm-hmm. with Melissa, and also in reporting. But what does it mean to reach functional zero?
So to the general person, functional zero would mean homelessness in our community is rare, it is brief, and it only happens once to anyone ever. On a more technical note, it means we have developed a system of care for persons who experience a housing crisis where we can identify and assist them within 30 days.
And what are the kind of moving parts to that system of care?
Great question. So part of a high functioning system of care in the homeless side means you have a group or people who are going out and doing outreach, identifying persons who are falling into homelessness or have some sort of housing crisis. You have another group that is doing something called coordinated intake, meaning this isn't just everyone lines up in order of when their crisis occurred or when it might occur. It means we actually look at how vulnerable is a person. There are some people out there that have severe and persistent mental illness. There are some people out there that have some pretty serious medical conditions or disabilities. They get prioritized. In our community, we also prioritize people based on the length of time they have been homeless.
Is that are those priorities set basically because they're just there's not enough resources necessarily to be able to deal with the problem?
Yes. Think of it like an ER. If I go in and I have a broken arm, but you come in and you have a heart attack, even if I got there first, you're going to get treated first because it's the level of severity.
And It's a
triage mentality, very much borrowed from the medical community and how they triage the most vulnerable. So in that coordinated intake, there is an initial assessment to try to see how vulnerable is a person. That may, like I said, that may include mental illness. It may include a physical disability. It could include a family with an extremely young child, maybe even a newborn. That kind of raises that vulnerability of that person or that household. So once we know that, we then work to match them with the available resources. For people who are most vulnerable, you've had other people on the program talking about permanent supportive housing. Mm-hmm. That would probably, if Sulzbacher or Ability Housing has been on that, they provide that level of service, which is a permanent place to stay.
Which is different than, say, these shelters
correct.
That have hours of operation and a capacity that once it's filled,
right.
those doors are closed.
So permanent supportive housing is an actual apartment. Sometimes Ability Housing would be our nonprofit developer in this community. They actually would build a complex where some of those units would be set aside for individuals that meet that qualification or definition. Agencies like the Sulzbacher, Presbyterian Social Ministries, and some others in town, they're actually going out, working with landlords. They're renting apartments in the market and providing those services wherever that person wants to live within our community.
We are starting to get a few calls. If you have some questions, comments, or just general statements that you want to make about this topic, we're talking about homelessness in Jacksonville, give us a call, 549-2937. Patrick in Arlington. Patrick, you're on the air.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I was homeless years ago, and the Sulzbacher really helped me get on my feet through the River Region program. And then, again, when I was down on the streets, I found like a lot of these homeless folks, some of them kind of want to stay in that situation. I mean, I'm not saying the ones with mental problems and stuff like that. I had mental issues at the time. But point is, it's up to a person. There's a lot of resources out there, River Region, and all those places. I guess that's about it.
Okay.
Thank you, whatever's happening on the radio. Thanks.
Well, I'm glad you got some relief and are doing better, Patrick. Thanks for your comments. So what about that? He says that he's experienced people who are reluctant to seek services. And I mean, is that something you've experienced in your work?
So Patrick is correct. Not everyone is ready for the services that we have at any given time. Part of we talked about reaching functional zero. That is something that a federal agency called the Interagency Council on Homelessness, the VA and HUD actually evaluate a community once we think we've reached it. So one of their criteria is, it's not that we have zero people who are veterans living on our streets. It's that we know by name every veteran who is homeless. If they choose at this time not to receive any of our services that we're able to offer, we continue to make contact with them at least every 2 weeks. So we know of people.
You're keeping track of them.
Yes, we are.
Right.
We know who they are. We know generally where they usually live or camp. We have outreach teams and navigators that go out on a regular basis throughout the three-county area. Part of what my team at Changing Homeless does is actually maintain that list of names or people. A group of our providers comes together every week, and we go through that names. People get added onto the list as they have a crisis. People move off the list as they get housed. So we work to make sure that that we know who people are. And with veterans, we're in a fortunate situation that we have most of the funding that we need to immediately assist a veteran who is literally homeless.
And those services a lot of times includes just connecting them to stuff that they have a right to. Their services with the VA or signing up with certain agencies, which
Correct.
A lot of homeless veterans don't always have the access to do.
So with the grant that my agency in particular holds, it is through the VA. And one of the things that we do is we have people who I would say they are experts in different VA benefits. And they, in the conversations and talking to the veterans, if they identify that a veteran is not receiving all of, say, the disability benefits or other benefits that they're entitled to either through the VA or other mainstream benefits, we work to get them connected to those. So that can't, sometimes that is enough for that's really all a veteran might need is just that little bit of help to navigate that system. A lot of times veterans, as I said, who are literally homeless will need some greater assistance. Mm-hmm. It may be something called rapid rehousing, where it's a short-term housing assistance with real intense help in job placement and assistance. And then sometimes it is that permanent supportive housing. For veterans, there is a partnership between the VA and HUD, and our housing authority houses hundreds of veterans annually. And the VA provides those services to them.
Well, we are getting some more calls and emails and comments from our listeners. I want to go to another one right now. Felix in Jack's Beach. Felix, you're on the air.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you. You're on the air.
All right, thanks. Hey, look, I wanted to find out how many organizations are there for homeless, because I heard a show, I guess last week, talking about that, and I wrote an email asking that I would like to contribute my time to this, because I drive around Jacksonville and I see a lot of homeless people. And I was just wondering if these organizations are actually not duplicating their work. I mean, do they all come, do they put their resources together and really, you know, help the people? I don't quite understand that. And how can a person like myself get involved with this? And I'm sure other people would like to as well. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Felix. So how about that? It seems like two questions here. First, Felix, it seems like he really wants to get involved and wants to help out. He wants to volunteer. Second, how many organizations are there in town, and does Changing Homelessness and these other organizations kind of work together?
So I will answer the second question first. Yes, we do work together. There are about 50 agencies, service providing agencies in the 3-county area. They're actually members of a coalition. We meet monthly at a general membership meeting. There's also those meetings that I talked about, those by name list meetings that are throughout our continuum, which is the 3-county area. So different agencies that would work with those different groups would come together, and those are actually weekly. So there is a lot of one-on-one or face-to-face communication. We also have a database that all of those 50 agencies can put information into. It is an open system, meaning that if you work for an agency and I work for an agency and we're serving the same client, we can tell that. So that helps eliminate that duplication of services.
So and helps to coordinate too, because then you could pick up the phone and call someone else in another department or agency.
Exactly. And it could be that someone is staying at City Rescue Mission, but they are receiving mental health care services from River Region. That's important for both of those case managers to know.
Right.
So they can coordinate services. So it could be a situation where that person, it would be better for them to move into an apartment, or they might be more stable at City Rescue Mission. And that's something they can case conference with, that type of information.
So I want to go move back to Functional Zero and see how close we are to reaching that at this point, kind of get an update on that. But first, we got an email from Scott Lutheran, who says there is a homeless man living at the off-ramp to Atlantic Boulevard eastbound on the Hart Expressway, Hart Bridge Expressway. Does your guest know about him? I guess this is a perfect way to ask the question, how difficult or easy is it to keep track of a population that by their very definition is transient?
So that particular person, I don't know if we know of them at this time. That's probably something, now that he has sent that, we will send someone out to see who they are and find out what their story is. As far as transient, probably the best data that we have is on veterans. And about 10 to 12% of the veteran population is highly mobile. Meaning they're not just moving from Duval to St. John's County. These are individuals that will, in a year, travel cross-country. Because of our partnership with the VA, we actually can see where people go to. Interestingly, the two most popular destinations after Jacksonville are Michigan and Montana. So, again, but that is a fairly small percentage of that population. The vast majority of people, probably 85 to 90% of them, lived in our community before they came homeless. Something happened that was an economic shock, or something occurred where they lost their housing here. So they're from here. They may not be born and raised here, but they were from here before it happened. And they want to stay here. This is their home. This is where their support network is. And that's where we work to help them stay in their community.
And if someone can if somebody wants to volunteer, can you? How do they go about doing that?
Well, Felix, if you're still listening, we are going to do a big volunteer effort on August 16th called "The Streets Don't Lie." As you were talking about, we are trying to demonstrate that we have reached functional zero. And again, to the person who emailed in, part of that is making sure that our by name list matches up really with who is out there. So we will have two volunteer shifts, 5 a.m. to 9 a.m. and then 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. We're going to go to our three known locations, or the most likely locations in our community to that homeless veterans are at, and that is the Urban Core, the Beaches, and Orange Park. And we do ask that everybody comes to a volunteer training session, and they can find out more about that by going on our website or Facebook page. And we also have the event up on Eventbrite. So if they search "The Streets Don't Lie" or "Veteran Surge," they can get a ticket, which is no cost. It's just so we know who is going to come to which of those trainings and which part of our community you want to volunteer in.
Okay, well, we have some more calls here from our listeners, and we're going to go to them in just a moment. But I wanted to clarify something. When you and I had talked about Functional Zero last, it was towards the end, or no, I'm sorry, it was in March of last year during a conference, during a regular meeting, I believe, that you had at the library. And you were hopeful that you might be able to reach Functional Zero by the end of 2016. Is this specific, "The Streets Don't Lie," is this a way to figure out whether we've reached functional zero? Is that the whole point of the...
It's one of the ways. You know, I had talked about that we also have a database and we have that by name list of all known veterans. Part of functional zero is demonstrating every quarter you are housing more veterans than are falling into homelessness. So one of the challenges... not only for Jacksonville, but for most large cities, especially cities that are near any kind of military installation, is we have a large number of veterans in our general population. So in Duval County, about 25% of the general population are veterans. We have reduced the veteran population amongst homeless to under 7%. So we are moving in the right direction for that, but we still have met in different quarters that technical definition of housing more people than become homeless. This is kind of our last surge to make sure that we have fully complied with any of the requirements that are out there.
So this is a very you do regular counts, but this is a very important count.
This is very important to us.
Particularly important.
Yes. You know, it also, this is focusing on veterans, but we will also be talking to anyone who is out there that is experiencing homelessness. It gives us a different snapshot at a different time of year of who is experiencing homelessness. It helps the entire community with our planning process as we look for funding for new projects or there's new opportunities. We know if they are needed and how much is needed in our community.
So we have got more than a few calls here. I want to start getting to them. Chuck is at the Beaches. Chuck, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. I was wanting your guest to see if she could please talk about perhaps what we could do as a community, a state, a government, to provide more Medicaid for people who have mental issues. Number of people in jails and prisons, et cetera, on the street. There's a huge amount of people who have mental issues. And my understanding is that it's very difficult for people to get on Medicaid, and it's very difficult. The Affordable Care Act, you have to make $12,000 in the state of Florida to be able to get on the Affordable Care Act. So what can we do to be more proactive? I like that word, proactive. Families don't know about mental issues. They don't understand them, and then things happen, and then their family members are self-medicating, sure, on the street, et cetera. Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck. Thank you for those thoughts. Yeah, there's an obvious intersection here between mm-hmm. people experiencing homelessness and people experiencing mental illness. And we have an issue in Florida. We are still at the bottom of the list, even though we've made some strides in recent years. We are still at the bottom of the list for mental health spending. How do we help this? How do we solve this with the resources that we have?
So I will give Chuck, thank you for that question. I will give the short answer because you can probably have yet an entire show dedicated.
Oh,
to
I'm
this,
sure,
and I think you actually have.
Right.
So if someone is not able to, does not have the resources to purchase health insurance through the open market system. In our community, there are the Sulzbacher is a federally qualified healthcare clinic, and they do provide mental health services as well as pediatrics and dental services. So that is.
But can they handle the demand for those services?
They cannot handle the demand. That is true. There's also a second Agape, and I am not as familiar with all of their different programs. But even with them together, there are still more people who need their services than we are able to provide.
So to Chuck's point, how much of this issue, homelessness in general, how much of this has to do with resources? How close could we get to solving some of these issues? We're always going to have to deal with homelessness. People are always going to fall on hard times. People are always going to suffer from mental illness or other ailments. But is this a resources issue? Can we do a lot better than what we're doing?
We can. It is no longer a question of can we reach functional zero? It's will we, as different communities, put the resources together to reach functional zero? Part of what the VA and other agencies at the federal government have demonstrated with their support of veterans who are homeless is when a system is fully resourced, over 50 communities have already reached functional zero, and I would guess at least as many more are right where we are, where we're on that tipping point. One of the differences between a veteran and the general population is a huge percentage of veterans have access to VA medical services, which include mental health and substance abatement services. Again, I think there is more demand than the VA is able to provide in any given month. It's hard to get in immediately.
Right.
But those services are.
We've heard about these backlogs where there was even descriptions of boxes of files filling up an office so much so that the floor was buckling. I mean, we've seen this before.
But they exist. Right. And people legally have the right to access those services.
Right.
For the general population, it can be much harder to access. I think that's one of the reasons with our really great partnership with our local VA employees, we have made success in housing veterans and then connecting them to those different services.
So we've got a couple more calls and I really want to get to them as quickly as we can because we are running out of time. But Tom is on the west side. Tom, what are your question or comments?
Well, first I wanted to say that I truly do appreciate and value the work that y'all are doing. Reminds me of the quote from the Bible, "In as much as you have done these to the least of these, you've done this to me." Traveling through Jacksonville a lot like I do, I see a lot of homeless. I fear the numbers may be larger than most people realize. And this is a problem that really needs to be addressed. And also wanted to say that while traveling through Jacksonville, I see the situation downtown with the two parks and the return to a separate but equal kind of thing, and I find that appalling, especially as in Jacksonville, most of us are one or two paychecks away from homelessness ourselves, and so we're all balanced on the edge of a razor, and that's my comment.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thank you for those comments. We haven't had a chance really to address the issues of stigma here the strategies that public officials more often than not use to to kind of deal with the problem of homelessness in public places like Hemming Park, for instance. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on what the local city government has been doing to address those issues?
So I'm going to flip it to an example that I've seen in Cleveland, Ohio. I had the opportunity to go with the chamber on a downtown trip with the Chamber of Commerce. Cleveland has made remarkable progress in what we call the unsheltered homeless population, people who are literally on the streets. So part of what they chose to do as a city county is, they focused resources first on shelters that were low barrier shelters, meaning anybody could walk in and get shelter for a night.
Now, there are some rules behind that. Can you just quickly explain? There are certain shelters that require certain things from those who are wanting to enter.
Correct. And this is different than that. These are specifically low barrier to enter.
Come as you are.
Even if you do not want a program, if you just need to get off the streets for a night, they have a separate room that people can go in. And then they actually have two separate shelters, one for men, one for women. The other thing that they have done is for the past 10 years, they have figured out how to build at least one apartment complex for permanent supportive housing. So they have built up their inventory of deeply, deeply affordable housing with supports. At the same time, they have a way for people to come in off the street, no questions asked, so they are safe. I mean, in the winter, Cleveland is very different than Jacksonville, so there is more of an incentive for people to come in. However, for us, it's the summer. If people are going to die in our streets, it's in the next couple months. It's usually
heat stroke,
heat exhaustion, dehydration. All those things are very dangerous for people who do not have a safe place to go.
Well, I want to get to another point here that we haven't had a chance to really talk about. The face of someone experiencing homelessness is not a single type of person. It's
correct.
Not a single face. And one thing that we have seen over and over again, most recently during a town hall with Congressman Al Lawson, are that in terms of veterans' homelessness, there are lots of shelters that seem to cater to male veterans experiencing homelessness. And a lot of veterans, female veterans who were at this town hall, were concerned that not enough attention was being paid to female veterans, but also just women and families, women and children in general, who also experience homelessness.
Correct. So nationally, about 25% of all persons who experience homelessness are female. The stereotype that we have in our head usually is an older male, and we don't recognize or see often a woman who's experiencing homelessness. Women, just like the average or the general homeless population, skew young and old, meaning most of the women that we see are young women with young children, or they are women who are 45 and above. So while there are, and the female veterans are correct, there are very few VA programs specifically for homeless female veterans. The Sulzbacher Center is building their new Women and Families campus that will have units dedicated to single female veterans.
Any idea of how many?
I believe it is eight.
Eight.
Which is fairly small, but it is in line with how many female veterans we generally find who are literally homeless, meaning they're actually on the streets, not in any other.
And female veterans specifically, not necessarily women.
Correct.
In general.
So those eight are for female veterans. Mm-hmm. The rest of that facility is going to be for other single women and for families with minor children.
Mm-hmm.
So families, young children, women in general, that is something that is on our radar. When we talk about our by name list, These are also different things that we are tracking and trying to figure out how to meet that unmet need.
Okay, so quickly before we go, can you give out the specifics or where people can find more information about the Veterans Surge next month?
Okay, they can look on our website at www.changinghomelessness.org. They can also check out our Facebook page, same name, Changing Homelessness. I will get to your office so we can, when you put the blurb up on the conversation today, we'll have a link to where people can show, can register. And if people are familiar with eventbrite.com, they can look for the Streets Don't Lie event, the Veteran Surge, and sign up there.
So changinghomelessness.com, or a little bit later this afternoon when we get the blurb and the show up online, you can go to WJCT.org or WJCTnews.org, rather. She's the CEO of Changing Homelessness, Dawn Gilman. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Back in a moment.
Next time on 1A, football and the brain. A new study of former NFL players' brains found significant damage in nearly all of them. Some say football is too dangerous to play. Others say it's too irresistible not to play. How can we protect America's favorite sport and the athletes who literally risk their lives to entertain us? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
Joey Petty works in shipyards, which can be dangerous work.
But that's what you gotta do to feed your family in this corner of the world.
Some days are more dangerous than others.
As I was stepping on the boat, it just a boom, boom, boom. Three big flashes, explosions.
The companies that build the Navy's fleet on the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Many people in Jacksonville never come in contact with those outside their core communities. WJCT is embarking on a journey called Beyond the Core to start a citywide conversation about what unites the people who call Duval County home and what makes our smaller communities unique. We might have an upcoming Beyond the Core listening event in your neighborhood. Check WJCTnews.org to find out.
Remember to pack your kilt when you go to the Highland Games and Dance Festivals in Scotland.
And each of these Highland dances has a story to it.
Or head down the coast to see some of the oddest sights in England.
And they really look like something out of an H.G. Wells novel. There are these sort of giant hulking things on four legs that stick up out of the ocean.
Hear all about it on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday mornings at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Listen to Hotsy Totsy Sunday nights at 9, celebrating the music from the 20s and 30s, only on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
Oh, everything is a Hotsy Totsy now.
Welcome back. We've spoken to many celebrities over the years on First Coast Connect, and you've told us now and then that you'd like to hear them again. Well, today we have some time to do just that. Listen as we rebroadcast Melissa's interview from last year with writer Dave Barry. He mounts a spirited defense of the weirdest state in the union, Florida. Take a listen.
Dave Barry, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
And you've spent many years defending your homeland, Florida, to much hilarity. Now you've compiled all of it in this book, and it's, I think, by turns hilarious and excruciating for Florida residents to read. But it must have been fun for you to write this and put this together. How did you draw upon the source material? Because, of course, there's no shortage of material.
Yeah, well, it started you know, I live in Miami. I've been here 30 years, and for a long time, Miami was kind of the joke, but not so much Florida. And I was sort of used to defending Miami, even though pretty much every bad thing anybody ever says about Miami is true. And I even had bumper stickers put up once that said, come back to Miami, we weren't shooting at you. But then with the 2000 election, the whole state of Florida sort of became the butt of jokes.
Mm-hmm.
We were unable to figure out who we'd voted for. I don't know if you remember that night, but...
Yeah, oh yeah, I was here.
Gore was leading, and Bush was leading, and for a little while, William Shatner was in the lead. You know, it was like, we had no idea whom we'd voted for. So Florida sort of became the joke state that, from then on, really, and then this whole Florida man thing on the internet.
Yeah.
So I decided to write a book defending the state, and pointing out that a lot of yes, there's a lot of weirdness here and a lot of insane people, a lot of stupid people.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the time, they're not from here. I mean, a lot of people aren't from Florida. They come down here to commit weird acts in Walmarts and whatever. So the part of the book is that, and then part of it is a kind of a love letter to the state. I traveled around to a bunch of places, some of them pretty obscure, some of them kind of old Florida tourist attractions,
mm-hmm.
but things that were really just purely Florida places and that you wouldn't find somewhere in the other state, and wrote about them. And a lot of the book is that.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about everything from the skunk ape to the Weeki Wachee mermaids and obviously Disney World, but some other attractions, too, that are just so kitschy and strange that you would only find here.
Yes. And I'm talking about strange, one of the stranger ones, I went to a town called Casadega, which is north central Florida. And it is one of the creepiest, weirdest places I've ever been to in my life.
Did you get a reading? I got a psychic reading there once.
It's a spiritual, they call itself the spiritual capital of the world. Everybody there is a psychic or a medium.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed at the Casadega Hotel. This was right before Halloween, which is a kind of a especially creepy time there. And went up the street and had a reading done, and it was a bizarre experience. Partly because the woman kept looking behind me. The woman, she was a medium. She said, you know, she was in touch with the dead. And you know, we'd be sitting here in this kind of darkened living room with candles burning and New Age music playing in the background. And she'd go, oh, I see, thank you. And I'd go, what? She goes, oh, I wasn't talking to you.
So, she was talking to someone who came through for you.
Somebody, yeah, except that whoever it was didn't really know very much about me.
Aww.
I had a lot of trouble finding any spirits who had any real connection with me. I also got a reading done for my dog, Lucy.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't have my dog with me, but they can do a reading with... They get your dog's aura from a photograph. So I have a picture of Lucy on my phone, and they took a picture of my picture and then put it through this printer that made this, like, rainbow pattern, which they told me was Lucy's aura. And I didn't know Lucy had an aura. Lucy has a smell sometimes, but I never know.
Okay, so Cassidy...
And they did this reading with Lucy where they said that my mother, who is deceased, came and played with Lucy every night, which struck me as pretty funny if you knew my mom, that she would, you know, visit Florida for that purpose. But anyway, it was interesting.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you a little bit about our corner of the state, North Florida, which is very different from Miami.
Yeah, you're really more like the South than the North, aren't you?
In a lot of ways, yeah.
I mean, you're north of Florida, way north of us, but down here, we have like... Well, I live in Miami, which is basically Latin America. I mean, my joke is I moved here in 1986 from the United States. But then a little north of us, Fort Lauderdale, especially Boca, that area, it's, you know, everybody's from New York.
Right.
New Jersey, Long Island. And then if you go west over to Naples, everybody's from Ohio or Michigan. But when you get up toward you guys, it's the real South back up that way.
And what do you think that says about Florida?
Well, it's just that we're not one state. That that is always, I think, as long as I've been here, been true. Floridians, I guess there are some older, you know, folks born and raised and whatever, who view themselves primarily as Floridians. But down here, especially, and I think much of the state, Orlando, a lot of the fast-growing areas, people live in Florida, but they don't identify as Floridians the way people from like Missouri identify as Missourians, or from Indiana identify as Indianans. I think in Florida, it's like we're here. It's a weird place. It's warm. The weather's nice sometimes, but there's a lot of strange people here, mm-hmm. and I'm still sort of connected with where I came from.
Right. So. Yeah, there are definitely more people up here who have that sort of native Floridian identification.
Right, right. And it may be why the two ends of the state do not get along all that well. I mean, you know, politically and I guess maybe culturally. It's just like, I know that when we, from the way deep South Florida, drive all the way up there, you know, we feel like we're in a whole different world. And then, you know, for one thing, you folks are nice and polite. We're not used to that. You probably, I'm guessing you signal your turns.
Yeah, actually, most of the time. They don't do that in Miami so much, do they?
In Miami, that's viewed as a sign of weakness.
Ah, I see.
My line about Miami is that when you get here, you think nobody knows the law of driving, and then after a while, you realize everybody is driving according to the law. Of his or her individual country of origin.
So. Exactly. You know, well, and you write so hilariously about these types of things, and you have for so many years. You're such a beloved writer and columnist and book author. Do you feel like you'll ever exhaust this subject?
Florida, no, because, first of all, it's a nuclear reactor of weirdness. I mean, the strange things just keep happening here. And the other reason is new people keep showing up, which is part of the reason why strange things keep happening. But we're up to 20 million people. We're the third biggest state now in population. And you just have a mixture of people down, especially down the southern end, that it's volatile and it produces news constantly. So if you're in my business of looking for humor to write about, you don't have to worry about it ever running out. It never will, I don't think.
That's good news for you. Good news for us as we get to read your stuff. Dave Barry, such a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Welcome back. Finally this morning, in early June, the Labor Department finally implemented what's called a fiduciary rule, or a best interests rule. What does that mean? Well, in short, it standardizes rules for brokers and registered investment advisors. Our RIAs have always had to operate under the best interest rule, which simply means they have to act in the best interest of their client. Brokers and insurance agents haven't always had to until now, at least for brokers. To talk more about this, we now welcome to the show Jay Rolfe of Fortress Wealth Planning. Jay, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to start off with a little bit of a vocabulary game, okay?
Okay.
Because some aren't necessarily all
that
familiar.
Pass, fail?
Well, you know, I'm not even sure if I'm the person that can grade it, to be quite honest. But anyway, I'm going to give you a couple of words, and then if you can just give me a concise definition. So fiduciary or fiduciaries?
So a fiduciary in the advisory world is someone that has a legal obligation to do what's in the best interest of the client, to place the client's interest first ahead of their own. So it goes back to the definition of a fiduciary, which is a duty of loyalty and care. So it really kind of places the emphasis on doing what's right for the client.
All right. And a broker?
Well, a broker is a registered representative. It could be registered at the state or federal level. And a broker is typically an agent for a broker-dealer. A wirehouse, an investment banking firm, and their role is more to recommend transactions, the purchase and sale of securities or mutual funds.
And an advisor?
Well, an advisor, again, that can have a lot of definitions
of
and meanings. And so part of what the Department of Labor fiduciary rule is trying to address is a uniform standard of care, okay? Because we've got the brokers, the broker-dealers of the world that have what's called a suitability standard. The fiduciaries of the world have the fiduciary standard. The DOL fiduciary rule says that for all advisors, all financial professionals offering advice for qualified retirement accounts, they're subject to the fiduciary standard, doing what's in the best interest, placing the interest of the client first.
And can you kind of expound upon what that other standard is and how it really differs?
Sure. So maybe a simple illustration would help.
Sure.
Okay, so typically a client has hired an advisor, and it's going to start with developing a client profile. So that would involve knowing what the client's objectives are, knowing what their needs are, knowing what their financial resources are to help them meet their objectives. What's the time horizon? What are short and long-term goals? What's their risk return expectations, risk tolerance, those sorts of things. All those things go into building a client profile. And from that, the advisor makes recommendations or provides advice. Mm-hmm. So under the fiduciary standard, the advisor, again, is making those recommendations, offering that advice, placing the interest of the client first. What's in the best interest? What's most prudent for the client? Under the suitability standard, which is a lower standard, it's what's suitable to fit those objectives, which may or may not be in the best interest of the client. And where the conflict arises is where an investment that is suitable may be a higher cost investment, may be a lower performing investment, but it's more to the advantage of the advisor versus the client. So the advisor has put their interests ahead of the client. And that's the rub, and that's what the Department of Labor ruling was trying to address by making it uniform, the fiduciary standard for offering advice in qualified retirement accounts. So that's your corporate 401k, that's a 403b that would impact public school employees or not-for-profit hospital employees and IRAs.
So you said that this brings up some questions that any potential client should have for a potential advisor. If they're trying to hire somebody to help them invest for retirement, what are some of the questions that you should be asking when you walk into that office?
That's a perfect segue, Ryan, because I think the unfortunate reality is that a lot of folks don't know what standard they're operating under. So a first question would be, are you a fiduciary? Is your advisor a fiduciary? Is your advisor operating under the fiduciary standard? And have them disclose it to you and have them put it in writing. What's the standard under which they're operating? And that segues very quickly into, how are they compensated? How are they paid? Are they an advisor under a fiduciary standard would typically be paid on an hourly basis or on a fee basis.
Like a lawyer would be.
Like a lawyer on a fee basis, where it could be a flat fee or it could be a fee, a percentage of assets under management. The broker-dealer world would typically be compensated by commissions. Mm-hmm. So you want to know, how is your advisor being compensated, and have it put in writing, have it disclosed in writing so you know. So there's a clear understanding about how your advisor is being compensated for the advice that they're providing.
Now, obviously, this is a major change for potential investors, for potential clients. But what does this mean for those that are in the retirement investment business? I mean, what do they have to do, really? I mean, do they have to put this the fine print on the front of all of their literature or offers, or how does this work?
So you've done your homework. that's a great question. So part of it is it's compliance. So for those advisors that haven't been operating under a fiduciary standard, it's the cost of setting up the administrative mechanism to comply with the cost of the DOL fiduciary standard. And so it is documentation. It is documenting that someone has gone through the profile. It is disclosing how fees are to be rendered. So that's why.
So if you ask for this information and they don't want to volunteer it, then they're not complying.
They should be in a position to provide the information and provide disclosure. And you've done your homework in terms of part of the debate over the the Department of Labor ruling is what does best interest mean and what do you have to do to comply with it. So part of the impetus was to put the burden on the advisor to provide it, to disclose it. Part of the debate is placing the burden back on the client to ask for it first.
Ah, I see. So they have to it's the difference between, okay, you have to provide it if it's asked for, but maybe you don't necessarily have to provide that information up front as a matter of business.
But the fiduciary, someone that's operating under a fiduciary standard should provide it.
Right.
Should provide it and provide it in writing.
And people are already doing this in other sectors. So, I mean, it's not really new for the business as a whole.
No, you make a great point. So the registered investment advisory world, acting as fiduciaries, is already doing this. Mm-hmm. Is there an additional cost to comply with the new ruling in the retirement world? Keep in mind that the Department of Labor ruling only applies to qualified retirement accounts. It doesn't apply to taxable accounts. So that's a whole other area. But a registered investment advisory firm acting as a fiduciary uses that fiduciary standard for not just retirement accounts, but taxable accounts as well.
So lastly here, I know that, or actually I have a couple more questions. The second to last here, very quickly, what process is there, if any at all, for those that have already kind of signed up and yoked themselves to an advisor?
No, that's a great question. It doesn't have to be interviewing a new advisor, Ryan. It's a lot of people just don't know. Mm-hmm. They don't know, again, what sort of structure they have to their advisory relationship. Ask to have it put in writing. Ask to have what standard of care are you operating under? How are you compensated? Those sorts of things. To be educated, mm-hmm. to know. And we're not passing judgment. There's not necessarily a right or wrong. It's just awareness. It's full disclosure.
Right. Well, lastly here, I know that there's going to be some more aspects to these rules that will be implemented by January 2018. Can you just give us a really, really, really quick readout of what those are?
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of the full implementation of it. It's the full documentation of it. And there's ongoing debate. You know, the brokerage industry is fighting this in part because of the perceived cost of compliance, and also probably because it may be the impact on the bottom line for both the broker dealers of the world as well as their registered representatives.
Well, Mr. Rolf, thank you for taking all of us, our listeners and myself included, to financial school this morning. It's been a pleasure.
If I could just add one point at the end. So if your listening audience has any questions or wants more information about it, they can certainly go to our website, which is www.fortresswealthplanning.com, and to get more information about this.
Great. He's Jay Rolf with Fortress Wealth Planning, and he joined us today to talk about a new Labor Department rule. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app to listen anytime. I'm Ryan Bank, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.